I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. This show is where we host thoughtful conversations with people across my personal and professional network who possess deep experience, wisdom, and insight about the issues shaping our communities, our future, and our economy. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing people together, leaders and thinkers who are willing to have an honest discussion about our state and our country. Visit lockedin.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contribution helps us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. America feels more divided than ever, but is politics really the root cause? Today, I'm joined by Lenny McAllister for a conversation about leadership, identity, community, faith, and the challenges of finding common ground in a culture increasingly defined by political tribes and social silos. Lenny, thank you for locking in with me, man. How are you today?
I appreciate being locked in with you today, kind sir. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, I'm so grateful to have you here. My audience may be aware that I recently was on Lenny's show, which is News Radio KDKA. I'm going to say that slowly, Lenny, so I don't mess it up. And I recently just posted the full conversation from our discussion, Lenny. I posted that on my Facebook page today. My audience can also go to lockedin.cash if you want to listen to that great interview that Lenny hosted a couple of Sundays ago. So, Lenny, this is your inaugural appearance on the Locked In Show. I know how famous you are across the country. You're an author. You're a political commentator. You've been on mainstream media. You have your own radio show. You're all over the place. But I don't want to assume that my little North Carolina audience may be fully aware of who you are. So let's just start with a little bit of an introduction, give people some context.
Well, I got to make sure that I tweak what you said, Algernon, because North Carolina is not little. In fact, in my book, A Venn Diagram of One, An American Story, I make it a point to put the lake shore of Lake Norman on the cover as part of the artwork, just because of my hat tip for the affinity and role of the Kakalaki in my life. So trust me, I don't see anything little about North Carolina and made me in many regards who I am today. But I'm Lenny McAllister. I'm a Pittsburgh native. I am a proud alum of Davidson College, the home of the greatest shooter in basketball history, Stephen Curry. I spent well over about a quarter of my life in North Carolina. I love North Carolina so much that I made it a point to marry a daughter of North Carolina, a woman that I've been proud to be married to over the course of almost a quarter century now, Lenny McAllister. I am a father of five, including one son-in-law, soon to be two grandchildren that'll be born. The second one's gonna be born later on this month. And I've had the unique opportunity to work with everybody from political and cultural leaders in North Carolina, the Pearl Burris Floyds and Kevin Daniels and Dr. Jerry Grimes's, but also, you know, have ties to Tom Tillis before Tom Tillis even got elected to the State House before going to the U.S. Senate, working with Pat McCrory when he was Mayor Pat before he was Governor Pat McCrory, but also having a very unique arc where I've also had a chance as a Black Republican to work with Michael Steele at the RNC when he was chair of the RNC, to have a relationship with Kay Coles James when she was head of the Fair Heritage Foundation, but also work with the late Jesse Jackson Sr. as a special advisor at Rainbow Push Coalition, as well as Roots senior advisor and former president of Chicago State University, Dr. Wayne Watson. So my experience has been one where I've had a chance to be a unique Venn diagram of one, taking all these different experiences from Charlie Kirk to Jesse Jackson and pulling him into my personal experience and showing how, even though we are divided, even though our politics and our cultural issues divide us these days, we still have some commonalities amongst us.
I love it. And to my audience, I told you, this guy has been all over the place. He's done a little bit of everything. So I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation today. I oftentimes like to say I knew Tom Tillis before Tom Tillis became Tom Tillis. A lot of people only came in the awareness of Senator Tillis once he got to Washington, but he had done so much great work right here in North Carolina. And I am one that still believes some of the growth in the business climate in North Carolina is a direct result and consequence of him being Speaker of the House. And I know this is wishful thinking, but I just so hope that Tillis comes home and runs for governor. I'd be the first one out there knocking on doors. Lenny and Lanny, that's a really interesting combination. No doubt you all are definitely soulmates.
Yes, definitely are. And if you look at our shared history, Algernon, I mean, some of the things that people may learn from the book, but would also learn in just kind of following our arc, you know, Lenny and Lanny McAllister were both second act students, you know, whereas I graduated with a thank you, Lord degree from Davidson College in regards to my GPA. She graduated magna cum laude with a degree in biology just this past spring. She won the Mendelian Award, which is over my shoulder. One of these shoulders, she won the Mendelian Award for Excellence in Biology from Carlo University, as well as traveling, and this is definitely over my left shoulder. She traveled to the Galapagos Islands as a researcher with her biology group, a group of excellent students, just last spring. So a person that survived domestic violence, and I survived gun violence. We went on these second acts, if you will, to be the type of Americans that can show folks that you can stumble along the way, but in America, you can get up, dust yourself off, and keep it moving. So in that regard, we have these really, you know, powerful stories that kind of mirror each other. But then there's also these little strange, you know, twists and turns, like both of our parents are born July 1942. Her parents' anniversary for their wedding is my birthday. So, I mean, we have these little weird things that if we ever doubted that God put us together for a reason, there's just enough evidence there where you just look at the artifacts and you go, okay, God, I see what you're doing, and I will obey. I will be obedient. So it's been a blessing to be married to her and have her be my soulmate to walk on these journeys together.
I absolutely love that story. And you all, I've observed you from afar for many, many years, and I'm always impressed with just the type of couple you all are, the family that you all are building and creating. So as my grandfather used to oftentimes remind me, even when you think people are not watching, people watching. Are watching, Lenny. So congratulations on everything you all are doing. You've already mentioned the book, A Venn Diagram of One. That's one reason I wanted to have you on the show. I have notes for my audience. I have not read the book. I've not received my autographed copy either. I'm going to just put Lenny out there right now.
No, you can't put the book's available for pre-order. The book hits bookshelves nationally on August 11th. But right now, people can go to LennyMcAllister.com or go to Barnes & Noble or on Amazon. You can pre-order the book. You can pre-order the audiobook. But I will tell you, Algernon, if you try to buy the audiobook right now, it's only 50% done. I haven't recorded the rest of it yet, but it will be there in August as well.
That's so exciting. Let's start there. What inspired you to write the book? I mean, what really triggered you to write A Venn Diagram of One?
Two things. Number one, division. Just the division that you see in the country, and people have gotten to a point of time where they believe culturally, politically, from a public policy perspective, even from a faith in America perspective, that this country cannot be fixed, that the brokenness is permanent and can't be reversed. And so as I look at my life, and I look at the stumbles that I had in my life, and I look at the grace that I was able to get from a faith perspective, but also from a secular perspective, I push back on that notion. Then from there, I had two very close mentors of mine, two African-American men that both died in their 50s. The late Reverend Dean Nelson, who is a co-founder of the Frederick Douglass Foundation nationally, and Douglasson Leadership Institute, as well as the late Dr. Christopher Metzler, who was the godfather to my younger two children. Having them die suddenly, just a couple of years ago, really put life in perspective for me. I saw how they were as national leaders. Both of them were African-American conservatives, worked within the Republican Party. Dean Nelson was very, very prominent in the pro-life community, creating a lot of pregnancy crisis centers around the country, as well as Dr. Metzler, who had worked with Republican strategists over the years, including Mrs. James at the Heritage Foundation. And it just made me say, Algernon, I need to see what I need to do next. How do I step up as a thought leader, not just a media personality, not just as an adjunct professor, not just as somebody that's doing public policy? How do you drive the conversations in the right direction so that the work that they did can be continued and fulfilled, and I can be the right type of leader for this country at a time where we are indeed broken and divided, but in need of coming back together?
So you started out with I think a really powerful question, and one that you and I've even had offline when we reconnected. You stated, this country's broken and can it be put back together? I think you would get responses all along the spectrum if you went around and started asking people that question. So I want to ask you that question. I do believe the country is broken. I think our politics are broken. I think I spoke about that at length when you hosted me on your show. What are your thoughts about the brokenness that we're seeing in our country and within our politics right now? And as a tag along, Lenny, what's the solution? Can it be solved?
Well, let's go backwards with that. The solution is statesmanship and leadership. It can absolutely come back around once again. And the beautiful thing about American history is the fact that these things pivot very, very quickly. Let's just think about the spinning that we did over the course of the last 20 years. You and I grew up at a time where nobody thought that an African-American would be president of the United States. I write about in the introduction of the book that 5 years prior to Obama winning his 2008 election, the closest thing we had to a Black president was Chris Rock as a make-believe alderman from Washington, D.C. and head of state, going around with his brother, who was played by the late Bernie Mac, becoming the president in some type of shocking fashion after the candidate ends up dying and they just needed somebody to just kind of be a placeholder on the ticket. Prior to that, it was Deep Impact. It was Morgan Freeman when a meteorite was going to hit the earth and kind of wipe out parts of civilization. That's all we had from 1999 to 2003. And within 5 years, this guy with a Muslim name from the south side of Chicago ends up becoming president. And then within 8 years after that, we end up having a reality TV host becoming president of the United States. The good and the bad is American history has shown these abilities to pivot, be broken, come together, be broken, come together. Poor people in North Carolina and throughout the South, within a short period of time, took their pennies, took their brokenness, and changed the world with the civil rights movement. They changed South Carolina and South Africa with what they did in the South in America over a short period of time. I do think that the brokenness can be fixed, but it takes a level of intentionality, and it takes some statesmanship, it takes some leadership, and it takes people to be visionary and loving despite what we see all around us these days.
You know, you talk about the rise of former President Barack Obama and then even the subsequent rise of the first administration of President Donald Trump. And, when I look at this country right now, there seems to be this ricochet that occurs. And you just highlighted it. You said we're broken and then we come back together. We come back together, then we're broken again. And it just seems like we keep ping ponging between the two. I certainly believe that the election of Barack Obama in 2008 was what gave rise to Trump in 2016. I mean, it just seems like those two things are very much correlated and connected. So it's like we continue to move between these extreme opposites. So here's my question. Why do you think so many Americans feel forced to always choose a side?
Well, because we feel like we're caught in the middle and we don't know if the people that are supposed to be representing us in a representative form of our republic are actually truly listening to us and not just hearing us. You know, two things happened when Obama was elected in 2008. Number one, first African-American president who beat a former first lady, a former vice presidential nominee, 3 to 4 sitting senators, all at the same time, after winning his own crowded primary in Illinois not that long ago, just a couple of years prior. So you had that, but you also had the angst that came about as a result of the Great Recession. And as a result of that, people combined had all, combined those two factors and had all these cultural changes coming about, and they were still angry at the system. That anger at the system got hijacked first by the Tea Party movement, which was a well-intended movement that I was a part of. But it went from fiscal responsibility to cultural awareness. And once the Tea Party did that, you started seeing their ideology morph into something different that eventually got us to 2016, where a candidate came from the fringes and was able to take that momentum and win a very shocking election in 2016. Algernon, people forget, nobody, including most Republicans, They did not expect Donald Trump to win in 2016. You had Hillary Clinton trying to campaign in Georgia to flip Georgia from red to blue, campaign in Arizona to try to flip that from red to blue. There was a reason why she didn't go to the blue wall, because she thought she had that locked down. As a result, you ended up seeing people saying, we're sick of the system and we're sick of status quo. What was the campaign slogan of Donald Trump in 2016? It was two things: build the wall and drain the swamp. That together, and ended up being something that allowed people to take their anger and hijack it. But as you well know, when people are angry about money, they look for cultural reasons to also be angry about. We saw this in Nazi Germany with its rise. We've seen this in the South and in other places throughout America. It's something, unfortunately, that human nature has done over time.
When you talk about the cultural reasons that sort of give rise to these various political movements, I'll just label that as identity politics. And when you look at the past 20 years that you've highlighted, so let's go all the way back to the second administration of George Bush when he ran for re-election in 2004. That entire election got conflated with the war on terrorism. So if you were a patriot and you cared about this country and you wanted us to win the war on terrorism, then you had to vote for George Bush. And in fact, John Kerry got mirrored in a lot of conflict because apparently he wasn't patriotic enough. And so that became the beginning of this identity politics. One of the reasons I didn't really get fully on board with Barack Obama was because I felt like the entire campaign message was around just electing the first Black president. I didn't agree with a lot of the policy conversations and discussions that were occurring back then, and they ran counter to just what I believed from a policymaking perspective. Certainly as a Black man, I was happy to see that our race had made it this far to where now we were electing the first Black president. I recall people saying I wasn't Black enough because I wasn't supporting Barack Obama, and I just had policy differences with him back then. I was also a part of the Tea Party movement that came up in 2010. Mm-hmm. But again, that started to morph more into identity politics. Trump, I mean, certainly hands down, even his first run in 2016 was all about identity politics.
The birther movement.
Of course, you talked about the Black Republican movement, which I think is literally not even whispered around the halls of the RNC any longer. But at one point in time, they were trying to use identity politics in that regard. So at what point, Lenny, do we, or maybe we don't get back to this point where politics just becomes about substantive policymaking and not trying to get people to align their identity with a certain candidate or a certain party because they see themselves in that person?
What we have failed to do, Algernon, moving forward in this country is we have failed to be able to say that being a hyphenated American, as they used to say during the Tea Party movement, they would say, I don't want to be a hyphenated American. I'm not an African American. I'm just an American. No, you are an African American. You are Black and you're American. We need both sides of the hyphen to have equal weight. I don't want an Italian American to cast aside being an Italian American. Keep your culture, keep your traditions, and also celebrate fully being an American. Once we're able to do that in a genuine, substantive way, we can then subsequently embrace each other's cultures while then having really good substantive policy and being able to explain how and why certain policies make sense for your specific community. If you're an African American and you know that home ownership is going to be something that's much harder for you to obtain, just because your family has not had the opportunities that other communities may have had, we need to talk about how both general policies matter. And this is why, regardless of your race or your creed, you should vote a particular way. But you also need to be able to say, let me explain to you what happened with Dodd-Frank. And when they got rid of credit unions the way they did and raised the standards, how smaller banks and credit unions went away. And as a result, it made it harder for people in our communities to be able to get the loan for that first home, get the loan for that first business. This is why we need to make sure that we have good fiscal policy that allows for the free market to be more robust, that will allow you to find the opportunity to chase the American dream. You have to be able to understand the cultural nuances of America. We have over 325 million people here, and there's always been an iteration of immigrants and others coming in that always seems to add to the fabric of America. If you're not inclined to look at the current fabric of America, you're going to fray at the fabric of America. That's why you have to know about the nuances of culture without being so fixated on it, to your point, where identity politics ruins politics.
You know, one reason I like talking with you, Lenny, is that you're always very optimistic, and you have a very positive view of America. And sometimes I think I'm an optimist. I've been accused of being a pessimist. I just think that I'm a bit more of a realist. And so sometimes I just try to frame exactly what's going on. But when I listen to you, you have this sort of sense of optimism where you're able to maybe look beyond what we see today, and you're looking towards the future. Why do you have so much optimism about this country?
Number one, and I did write about this in a Venn diagram of one, I saw it in my life, Algernon. I mean, I was a guy that went around with Jesse Jackson Sr. as a senior advisor at one point in time, and Michael Steele as a senior advisor at one point in time. And not that long ago, I was cutting lunch meat behind a deli counter at the Braddock Hills Giant Eagle here in the Pittsburgh region. I was a guy that was a college dropout. I was a guy that was 50 pounds heavier than you see me on this camera right now. I was so many different things than what I ended up being. Then I look at American history. One of our greatest presidents in the history of our country and one of the greatest leaders in the history of the world was a guy whose dad didn't even want to deal with him. I'm talking about Abraham Lincoln, who had to be self-taught in the backwoods, who was a perennial loser, ends up winning the 1860 election. And as he wins for winning that election is, you know, one third of the country just leaving the Union almost immediately afterwards. You look at Frederick Bailey, who became Frederick Douglass, the most photographed man in the 19th century, a guy that got beat and tried to escape slavery and didn't always succeed and then eventually escaped. There are so many stories of different types of Americans that overcame, that overcame, that overcame, and then helped us overcome, that I have to keep that optimism. I have to say to myself that perhaps God put something very specific in my story, my pathway, that allows me to hold on to that optimism, remind people of where we came from, and then with a very pragmatic sense, start building out solutions that will help people achieve and realize that optimism. It's great to be optimistic, as you well know, but if you're not helping people build to bringing a real sense of optimism that becomes part of their actual reality, it's just words. My calling, I do believe, is to not only be optimistic, but to bring that optimism to actual life.
You know, one thing I definitely agree with you on, Lenny, if I had a magic genie right here and she asked me if I could go to any point in all of American history, what day would I choose to land on? And I would say Monday, June 1st, 2026. So despite, I think, some of the challenges that we see, and it can very easily, you can start to feel a lot of weight and an emotional weight related to a lot of the challenges that you see in our country, certainly within our politics. If you're a traditional conservative, which is how I describe myself, yeah. There's a lot of concerns right now about the Republican Party and the state of the party. But yet, despite all that, I do think we've made tremendous progress in this country. And I routinely tell people, never bet against America. You're gonna lose that bet. You've mentioned Michael Steele several times within your commentary today. He's someone I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I actually spoke at an NNPA conference in Washington, D.C. many years ago. He sat next to me at the head table, you know, patted me on the back when I came off stage. And, you know, for a 20-something year old Black Republican, I'd probably melted within my suit that night, Lenny, because I had so much respect for him. Anytime people would ask me, they would say, well, what kind of Republican are you, Algernon? I'd say, well, I'm a Condoleezza Rice. I'm a Colin Powell. Yeah. I'm a Michael Steele type Republican. Well, now when you look at the Republican Party, I mean, Michael Steele, who was a former chairman, certainly someone who was tasked with diversifying the party and bringing more Black Republicans within the party tent, he's largely been ostracized. You know, I mean, he's not even someone that people talk about within the party any longer. I mean, he still makes appearances on MSNBC and he's active. And I listen to his podcast. And this past weekend, Lenny, I was actually cleaning up some YouTube videos, came across a video that I made back in 2020 when Michael Steele actually endorsed Joe Biden. I mean, that's sort of how bad politics had gotten at that point. Well, ever since then, you know, Michael Steele's been a political enemy of the Republican Party, largely just because he disagreed with the party. But here's my question. How can people in this country disagree without becoming enemies? What was so remarkable about our founding fathers? We always want to talk about our founding fathers. Well, they largely didn't agree with one another. They all disagreed, and they would sit around tables at the tavern and have a beer and talk politics. And eventually those discussions and that tension and friction gave us the Declaration of Independence, probably one of the greatest contracts between a government and its people in all of history. But now when I look at 2026, and I do think we've made a lot of progress, it feels like we can no longer disagree without becoming enemies.
Well, first and foremost, in full disclosure, I have been a fan of Michael Steele's for quite some time. I've known him over the years. Like I said, I was a senior advisor for him, and he's actually one of the individuals that wrote one of the two co-forwards for A Venn Diagram of One. So it was a wonderful honor for him to be able to reflect upon our time together and put that at the very beginning of the book. But when I look back at where we are as a country, why we can and cannot agree, and how to get back to that, Algernon, we have to go back to a point in time where people both love America as well as love Americans. And if you can love both the people of the country and the concept of the country, love the people within the diversity and love the red, white, and blue, it's a lot easier to serve them. We need more people in elected office and people that are in positions of quote-unquote power that are going to be in those positions and love the people that they're serving more than the people may love them back. Service is never a 50-50 symbiotic, you know, completely equal dynamic. It's much like a marriage. You know, sometimes a year in your marriage, it's 75-25, it's 60-40, then it goes to 40-60, then it goes to 55-45. But you're there for the 100% of it all the time. We've decided in America that A, it needs to be 50-50 or 0-100. America doesn't work that way. They built this system to be built upon compromises. They built this system for us to be able to work with each other. They built this system to give people in government a lot of power, but only with the consent of the governed. If you're not remembering all these things and the people with that responsibility are not doing so with love in their heart, both I would dare say a love of faith, if you will, as a man of faith, but also an active civic love. You have to actively love America and do so in a way where you have a little when people try to stick you with slurs and slander. You have a little bit of tough skin when people try to harm you. You have a greater vision of where we're going versus what might be going on in the immediate. If you can start leading with that and have that be more of our ethos collectively, I think it'll be much easier for us to work together, work through disagreements, and get past the brokenness that you and I have been talking about, and many of us obviously have been experiencing.
Lenny, I love everything you just said. I love the fact that you referred to America as a concept. I have said that for two decades to people. I said we live in the United States of America, but America is just an idea. It's a dream. It's a concept. It's something. It's a vision that we should be trying to embody and live out. And it's a vision that we should be striving day in and day out to work to accomplish. And I had a mentor teach me so many years ago, I'm so grateful, that in America, politics should not be a blood sport. It should be about consensus building. It should be a real careful thought process, an intentional process around policy making, and not this zero-sum game that we beat each other's brains out. It's almost like we're starting to treat politics like a NFL game or an NBA playoff series, and
more like UFC. It's much more like UFC. It's not just I need to win on the scoreboard. I need to have you be incapacitated. I need you to not get off the mat. Well, the bottom line is in America, we all need to make sure that everybody gets off the mat because we're competing geoeconomically, geopolitically. Our military's out there. Our ideas are out there. Our concept of America and what a democracy should be, they're all out there. And if we have half of America laying on the map because we knocked them out, how do we think we're going to win these fights with one arm tied behind our back?
You know, Lenny, you talked about my audience being able to pre-order the book. So I want you to hit that one more time as we get ready to wrap up. But I also want to ask you a question for those in my audience that choose to purchase the book and read or listen. What message do you hope readers take away from your book?
First and foremost, that America is a land of second acts, and those second acts happen in America all the time at the individual level, the community level, and at the national level. It's all throughout our history, and we're primed for another one again. We would be primed to make the most of that if we're aware that every time we have an inflection point in our history, that we need to reflect upon what it means and then take the appropriate direction moving forward. I want them to see through the examples in my life, but also the historical examples I bring up, as well as the public policy that I mentioned, that this land is so unique because it provides second acts for all different types of individuals, regardless of where you've come from and what you have. And if you're willing to believe in America, you believe in God from a spiritual standpoint and believe in America from a secular standpoint, you can find the second act that we need collectively and individually moving forward from America 250.
Here's one of my last questions, Lenny. I'm listening to you in this conversation. And one question I have for you is, what do you think comes next for America? But as I listen to you, I don't know if this is the case or not, but as I'm listening to you, sound like a man that might be about to run for something. So also, what comes next for Lenny McAllister?
First and foremost, let me answer the question about America. I think that, unfortunately, we're going to have some more bumps in the road that we're going to have to go through. And this is why I did write the book, A Venn Diagram of One. It's to remind us of what we can be so that as we go through more of the bumpiness, we can cleave to something that allows us to elevate past the rocky road and start soaring again. So I'm hoping that people grab onto that and eventually we start taking off and we can rise above this as we have throughout our history. In regards to me, Algernon, you know, I will follow through any door that God opens for me. The bottom line is, I know I have a very unique history. I know I've been blessed with a very strong, beautiful, and unique soulmate. And for whatever reason, God's allowed me to be on all these different platforms as a kid from working class Pittsburgh, Penn Hills, to be able to speak to people like you, but also speak across the country. And if that's going to be the case, if God opens a door for me, who am I to say no and not walk through it? So I'm just trying to be focused on the work every single day, but also be ready to walk through any door that God opens for me. Serve in the process.
Such a beautiful response. And then here is my last question, because many of my audience know that I'm a huge fan of hospitality. I love locally owned restaurants, bars, breweries, cafes. I just think those types of small businesses are part of the real fabric of any community. And it doesn't matter if you're in Winston-Salem or if you're in Washington, D.C., Portland, Oregon, wherever. People want to know where to go eat. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to imagine that you're back in Charlotte right now. And I want you to tell my audience, what's one restaurant that you'd recommend in Charlotte?
Oh, the one that I would have recommended is one that is closed. It was Chicken Coop, which was a place that was just a delight because everybody from the mayor to the janitor all lined up. You either got your chicken wings or your chicken sandwiches with the sweet tea. They would literally write your order down on a brown paper bag, and you had to pay with cash. I loved Chicken Coop. When I went down there, I was heartbroken that it was gone. Now, my number two is not traditional, like soul food, if you will, even though these were not African-Americans that were making this food. It was fantastic. It's Rice Fun. So every time I come back from the South, whenever I do business or do public speaking or the like, I stop past this place. There's one in Mooresville. There's one in Statesville. There's one in Mooresville. But my wife and I had grown to love this place. It's like Asian fusion food. And I literally, Elgin, I will buy the food in Statesville, North Carolina, and then make the 6.5-hour drive back to Pittsburgh and give it to my wife as a surprise because we just have such fond memories of Rice Fun. Another runner-up as well is Joel's. It's another Asian fusion place that used to provide everything from sushi to just different types of Asian goods. And again, up in Lake Norman, again, we're wildcats. So needless to say, we're going to have a little bit of an affinity for Lake Norman.
This has been another episode of Locked In with Algernon Cash. I appreciate Lenny McAllister for sitting down for an honest and thoughtful conversation. If you value these conversations, then I invite you to support this work. Your donations help us continue bringing together leaders and thinkers who are willing to have honest discussions about politics, business, money, and the community issues most important to our state and our country. Visit LockedIn.cash to become a reoccurring supporter. Your contributions help us continue producing independent conversations that elevate our region. You can also subscribe to my podcast on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Share this episode and send it to a friend. I'm Algernon Cash. Stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.